Welcome to Scope It Out. In this episode, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Dr. Rick Chandra. They'll discuss the article, Safety and Tolerability of Surfactant Nasal Irrigations. This edition of Scope It Out is sponsored by Medical Center Pharmacy, leaders in topical sinus therapy for chronic sinusitis and polyp patients. Founded in 1990, MCP provides innovative formulations that combine steroid, antibiotic, and antifungal treatments. These medications are instilled directly into the sinuses using various devices. Successful insurance billing, thorough patient education, and prompt delivery are why physicians and patients trust MCP as their premier pharmacy. Please visit www.mcpnc.com or call 1-800-930-8785 for more information.
Hello and welcome to Scope It Out, the podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Smith, and today I'm very happy to be joined by Dr. Rick Chandra from Nashville, Tennessee. We will be discussing his article, which is currently available in Early View Online, entitled Safety and Tolerability of Surfactant Nasal Irrigations. Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Well, I appreciate you asking me to be here. This is very exciting that there's interest in our article.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it seems like we're irrigating and applying topical therapy like never before, I think, in our history. So this topic is particularly timely. Now, to set the stage, you were interested in looking at safety and tolerability of surfactants, particularly in nasal saline irrigation or the addition of a surfactant to a saline irrigation. And there was a time several years ago when this was not an uncommon treatment, perhaps even a fairly common treatment. It was common in my practice, I think. And then some reports of olfactory loss in these patients surfaced. And I think the use of surfactants seemed to really fall off at that stage. Certainly they did in my practice, although I never experienced a patient of mine having smell loss with surfactant therapy. This was primarily using baby shampoo at the time. I mostly just heard rumors of this and stopped using it to the extent that I once had, but I've always wondered what the real issues are. So explain, Rick, how you got interested in this topic or your history of using these things.
Compatible with what you said in your own view, where there were these uses of surfactants because a lot of data was coming out showing that they disrupt biofilms, and a lot of that extended to the character of the viscous eosinophilic mucin that a lot of these patients had, and there was some observations that the surfactant, which is essentially a diluted soap solution, was able to break that up too. These happen to be our most recalcitrant patients, and so even though it's a seemingly unnatural thing to wash the nose with soap, if there's some benefit in disease patients to manage biofilms and mucin, we thought it would be valuable. But there was some reports of patients using the product over the counter, presumptively otherwise healthy patients actually, where there were some tolerability issues. And so our goal is to see if first that if there were indeed these tolerability issues in healthy volunteers. The corporation that formulated the original recipe for the commercially available product went through a lot of research and development efforts to try to reformulate the product. And so the present study was really being done, sponsored by them, in order to see if this new version, this new formulation, had tolerability issues. Now, in a way, we've just talked about apples and oranges because, you know, I just told you that the patient population of interest are these chronic sinusitis patients with biofilms and eosinophilic mucin. But the group of patients that we looked at for the study were healthy volunteers. And the reason why is that when looking at tolerability or looking at outcome metrics such as changes in sense of smell, we thought that if we started with a population that was going to be most sensitive to these changes, in other words, normals, then we would be able to see the real magnitude of the effect under the most controlled circumstances.
Sure, and that makes a lot of sense to me. I think I learned a valuable lesson with this because I remember back in the day it was baby shampoo that the article came out. I think it was Alex Chu,
yeah.
His article that I was most interested in. And one of the outcomes he measured was a reduction in the symptom of postnasal drainage, which I find to be one of those symptoms that can be so recalcitrant. So I thought, oh, here's another therapy for those patients who come in with chronic rhinosinusitis, they're complaining of postnasal drainage. And I remember thinking to myself and saying to some of my patients, you know, this hasn't been studied in large populations, but it's baby shampoo after all. It seems innocuous enough, and we've probably all had baby shampoo go up our nose at some point in our lives, and we seem to be doing okay. So therefore, I suggested that these therapies would likely be quite innocuous and not be associated with either tolerability issues or certainly not olfactory loss. So when this happened, it made me think that, gosh, you really do have to study all of these things. Irrigations, over-the-counter irrigations and formulations, as you've stated in your paper, are very, very popular in this day and age.
I agree with that completely, and you know it's interesting too, because the anecdotal observations from baby shampoo having some value were nicely confirmed scientifically in that paper you're talking about. But the efforts have always been to make something specific for the sinuses, and that was the reason for the development of this whole line of products by that company. One disclaimer is I have no relationships with that company as a consultant or an advisor or anything like that. My only association with them formally has been the conduct of this study, which we did on their behalf without any remuneration to me or any of the investigators. But the idea that they were trying to formulate something that was specifically for the nose, I found interesting, especially because, after all, shampoos, even though we've all had baby shampoo in our noses at some point, that there are fragrances and emollients and things like that wouldn't necessarily be compatible with the sinonasal environment.
And this surfactant that you utilized in this study was just a quarter of the concentration of the surfactant that was commercially available at one point.
I believe so. The actual chemical formulation was proprietary to them.
Right.
It was similar ingredients, and it was a lower concentration.
Okay. And so, interestingly, you found some tolerability issues and some olfactory loss associated, it seemed, with the surfactant application.
In the data, we looked at two major outcome metrics. One was presence of congestion, and the other was a more objective metric, even where we used the 40-item smell identification test. This was a crossover study, so that all the patients had one treatment followed by a week of washout followed by the other treatment. Half the patients had the surfactant first, while the other half had irrigation with plain saline first, and then after the week washout, each arm switched to the opposite treatment. So it turned out, when you hashed out all the data, that after the surfactant phase, almost 30% of the patients had either moderate or severe congestion, while only 6% of the patients had that after the saline phase.
Right.
I mean, that was significant. We also did, as I said, the smell identification 40-item test. In that analysis, we looked at it two different ways. One is simply to see if there was a statistically significant reduction in the mean smell identification score. And there was, but that reduction was only 1.5 points in the surfactant group.
Out of a total possible of 40 points.
That's right. So even though that's mathematically, statistically significant,
right,
we thought that was clinically not meaningful. As a corollary issue, there's a lot of discussion about what a clinically meaningful reduction in smell identification score is. That's not been well borne out in the literature, but common consensus convention, I guess, is that it's at least 4 points. And so we looked at the data another way, trying to assess what proportion of the patients after surfactant had this clinically meaningful reduction versus in what percent of patients after the saline phase. And it turned out about 18% of patients had a clinically meaningful reduction in smell after surfactant versus only 3% after saline. So it means that there is a subset of patients in whom that there is a clinically meaningful reduction. Now, it turned out that in those six patients who did have that, we were able to find all but one of them for a follow-up smell test, and there was recovery. So it suggests that in these, again, otherwise healthy people, that it is reversible after stopping the therapy or after a saline washout phase.
Right, and yeah, that reversibility is important. I think the other caveat is this is relatively short-term use of this surfactant irrigation as well. I mean, it's really 1 week of use of the actual surfactant. Is that fair to say?
Correct.
So it brings up the implications of, well, if we're going to use this to treat a chronic inflammatory disease, we're likely going to use it for much longer than 1 week. And would we see incremental increases in the percentages of patients that would have this issue? Or, on the other hand, would the tolerability issues resolve with continued use of the product? I guess we don't know the answers to those questions.
So we looked, again, in healthy, otherwise normal people, that we know that there is some small but measurable impact of using this. The issue you bring up is the proverbial next study. Even if you saw the same range of findings in disease patients, the interpretation of those findings also depends on exactly who those patients are. Let me explain that. For example, you know, we all know that chronic rhinosinusitis, especially with polyps, is associated with smell loss to begin with. Chronic rhinosinusitis, generally speaking, is associated with congestion in virtually all of its phenotypes. And so if you already have a patient, for example, with congestion and who is perhaps chronically anosmic, incidental to the disease, then perhaps the therapeutic benefit of using a surfactant to break up biofilms or to break up eosinophilic mucus outweighs the potential tolerability factors because those patients already have those tolerability-related symptoms. That said, there might be another chronic sinusitis patient who has hyposmia, and in that person, you might not want to treat with something that might take away what residual olfactory sense there may be.
Yeah, I mean, I think my clinical experience is that some of the patients who are initiated on this therapy, they found great benefit from it, and they continued to use it despite the issues that were raised. And I think a lot of them perhaps fell into that category of patients that they've just failed all of the other typical on the beaten path therapies, and you really do have to get off the beaten path to find something that helps them make a step forward.
I agree with that completely, and these are also patients where there's a certain frustration level with the controllability of their symptoms well before we were even talking about these therapies.
So I guess the question for you, having investigated this, are you using surfactant therapy in your patients with chronic rhinosinusitis at this time?
In patients who are otherwise normosmic, I try them on it when we get to that point of frustration, but I am clear about what our study findings were, and I let them know at the first sign of that to please, sign of, say, olfactory loss, please stop it and notify me. Patients who are chronically anosmic, meaning ones who tell you that even after they take steroids, they still don't have any smell, sense, or taste. They've accepted long ago they don't smell anymore. And I tell them that the results of our findings, too, but that's probably irrelevant in you because we're treating you with this first because your congestion is so recalcitrant. And what this will do to help break things up will probably outweigh whatever the irritated side effects might be. And if there's any impact on your olfaction, it's sort of non sequitur because you lost that years ago. And most of them are just, they're interested in something that's going to help them break up biofilms and dislodge mucin plugs. The only ones where I'm hesitant to use it are in people who have fluctuating smell or are chronically hyposmic because I don't want them to lose what residual reserve they have.
The other thing, Rick, that strikes me about this study is that it's not common to find a study that's sponsored by industry that shows a product in not an advantageous light necessarily. This really kind of shines a light on the potential problems with this therapy.
You're addressing a much larger and broader issue of publication bias and done some industry-sponsored studies, and there's always something. There's a big learning experience for me, too, along the way doing, you know, there's data use agreements, and some companies reserve the right to block publications if it doesn't say things that shed good light on them. And I have to give credit to this company that they had no role in the, you know, in the study design or conduct, and they didn't micromanage any of the data analysis. In fact, they had nothing to do with the data analysis, but they didn't micromanage any of the, how the study was designed or conducted, is what I meant to say. Data analysis was done independently by us. There was no agreements or limitations about what we could or couldn't do with the data. It was done purely out of the interest of scientific investigation.
And I'm curious, when they saw the results of the study, when you saw the results of the study, I'm sure you were, based on your hypothesis, I imagine that you were somewhat surprised by these results. That the surfactant caused more tolerability issues and more olfaction loss than maybe you had guessed?
Maybe more than I had guessed, but not out of the range of what I thought was disturbing. And frankly, whatever the company decides to do with this data, they may decide that they're going to take the product to market and put a disclaimer on it. They may decide not to market it. I don't know. That's their business. I've never had any discussion with them about it. This is not an unusable product. It just has, just like any other, it's not pharmacotherapy in any official sense, but just like any therapeutic intervention we have, that there's benefits and there's side effects. And the purpose of this was to elucidate more about the latter. And that can be important in counseling patients in what is otherwise potentially a beneficial product for particular symptoms.
Yeah. Well, I think it is a very well done study. I think it answered or begins to answer an important question that's on our minds. It's certainly been on my mind about this. And so it's really helped me with regard to counseling patients, even though I'm using it in patients with chronic rhinosinusitis, you can still extrapolate some of these findings and at least have an informed discussion with the patient about products like this. So Rick, really do appreciate your work. And thanks again for joining me on the podcast. I certainly appreciate that.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed being here.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or of the sponsors.